All right. Good morning on this nice frigid morning. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
So we saw that the component of the Higgs that gives that vacuum expectation value,
yes,
is uncharged under the unbroken E1.
Yes.
Is there a scenario where the vacuum could get a charge? And if so, what would that mean physically? Is there a physical difference?
Okay. First of all, if you have a single Higgs doublet, the answer is no. In the SU2 cross U1 spontaneously broken by a single Higgs doublet, there's always a U1 that is left over. Now, if instead of choosing the making the arbitrary choice of the three component to be the one with the VEB, suppose I'd said it was the one component, then the theory would be absolutely identical. It's just that I would have sort of labeled my states the wrong way to begin with, and I would have had to relabel at the end which ones were charged and neutral. Now, if you go to a theory with two Higgs doublets, or a Higgs doublet and some higher dimensional representation, then it is possible to spontaneously break the entire symmetry. It depends on whether the two are aligned or not. If both doublets have a VEB and they're both in the, say, the bottom component, then, and if they're both in the three component, then electric charge will still be conserved and CP will not be spontaneously violated. If you had one doublet that was in the three component and the other, the VEB, was in the four component, charge would be conserved, but CP would be violated. One would be real, one imaginary. If you had one in the bottom component and one in the upper component, then charge would be violated. Which occurs is a function of the parameters of the Higgs potential. You can write down a potential, and depending on the parameters, it could go either way. The minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model is such that that has two Higgs doublets, but at least within the Higgs sector, it turns out that the parameters are constrained by supersymmetry, so the charge is conserved. Okay, that answers your question. Well, I'm on the subject, however. I'll say in supersymmetry, you've got all these scalars that carry color and charge. And it's not automatic that they don't have VEBs. You can easily have a supersymmetric theory that violates charge and color. That's not our world, but I mean, it's mathematically possible. Are there any other questions? By the way, we're far enough along in this course now that people who are interested in, you know, other aspects of particle physics other than what I'm specifically talking about, please feel free to come ask me about them. I'll be glad to talk to you about anything else. I don't guarantee to know it, but I may. So, okay, what I want to do now, though, is continue with the discussion from yesterday. I had, on Friday, I wrote down the Lagrangian for SU2 cross U1 with a bunch of terms. And then yesterday, I discussed the spontaneous breaking. And in essence, one has that the Higgs doublet became, in the unitary gauge, this form. Three of the components of the doublet disappear to become longitudinal modes of the now massive W and Z bosons, and one of them, the Higgs particle, remains. And this is a spin zero that, as we will see, couples to the fermions like a scalar. And I started by, I wrote out the kinetic energy term for the Higgs in terms of this form, and we saw that the part nu actually generated the masses for the W and Z, which were the weak mass eigenstates, and that there were also couplings of the H to the W and Z, which I'll talk about more tomorrow, possibly the end of today. But, and then I also took a simplified version with a single fermion family and rewrote the fermion, basically the gauge kinetic energy terms, in terms of the W and Z and photon, and showed that one obtained charge currents that were similar to the Fermi theory, and then the electromagnetic current, and a neutral current, the new thing. What I want to do now is be a little bit more realistic in considering the Yukawa terms and the fact that there are three families of fermions, not just one. So let me write the Yukawa interaction again. I'm only going to write the one involving the down quarks. It's very similar story for the, there's four terms for the down quarks, one for the up quarks, one for the electrons, one for the neutrinos, depending on which right-handed field comes into it. I'm just going to illustrate for the down quarks. So we had some sum Mn equals 1 to 3 of some gamma, some matrix for the down quarks, Mn here I have added the superscript 0, which I mentioned in response to a question the other day on Friday, but didn't really write. And the 0 simply means these are the fields we started out with. They're the ones in the Lagrangian, and the U0 and D0 left are a definite weak doublet with a transition between them. The C0 and S0 are another doublet with a couplings between them, et cetera. But they are not necessarily the mass eigenstates. And this can be, and I'm mainly interested here in the, well, there's a term here, phi at this point has not yet been rewritten. So this was just the form that we started with. So there's one term that involves the phi plus and one term that involves the phi zero. And it's the latter that I'm really interested in. So this can be rewritten in a matrix notation as minus d bar 0 left phi 0 d 0 right plus Hermitian conjugate plus a term that's like u bar phi plus d that I'm not so interested in, or minus actually. So this is just a, and there's a, I'm sorry, there's the gamma here, of course. So here, the, of course, the D0, right, is really a shorthand for D10, D20, D30, left, and D0, right, is D10, D20, D30, right, and it's simply a matrix notation for that. Okay, so I'm going to forget about this. The phi plus is going to disappear in unitary gauge after applying the Higgs mechanism, and or if you will, I'm simply going to replace now phi by 0 nu plus h, in which case this term just disappears in the unitary gauge. And it becomes minus d bar 0 left md, and I will define this momentarily, times d0 right times 1 plus H over nu plus Hermitian conjugate. And MD is simply the matrix gamma D nu over root 2. It came from nu over root 2 times gamma. I'm just calling that M. And M sub D is called the down quark mass matrix. And it is a 3x3 matrix, assuming three families. And just like gamma, it's completely arbitrary. It doesn't have to be Hermitian or symmetric or real or anything. You can even generalize this to so it's not square, but I'm taking three lefts and three rights. And there's a similar matrix for the up quarks, for the electrons, and for the neutrinos. So there's four general matrices. And most of the arbitrariness of the standard model is in these matrices, or correspondingly in these matrices. Now, what do we make of this matrix? Well, it's just like in quantum mechanics. In elementary quantum mechanics, you have a Hamiltonian, and if there's only one state in your system and an energy eigenstate, that's fine. But if you work in some basis other than the Hamiltonian eigenstate basis, your Hamiltonian will be a matrix. And what you do when you have a matrix, you diagonalize it. So we're going to diagonalize this, and the eigenvalues are going to be the masses, and the eigenvectors are going to be the actual observed quarks. Yeah?
Since MD is not necessarily Hermitian, does that mean that it's possible in degenerate cases to not have mass eigenstates?
Well, that was practically my next sentence. We know how to diagonalize a Hermitian matrix. A Hermitian matrix can always be diagonalized as a similarity transformation. So for A, so for M equals Hermitian, you can always find a unitary matrix which diagonalizes. And this matrix is more or less unique, up to some phases and labelings, et cetera. If there is a degenerate, you mentioned a degeneracy, then obviously anytime there are degenerate eigenvalues, there's you can go to whatever linear combination of the degenerate ones and call them your basis. This is a Hermitian matrix. There's a similar theorem for a square but arbitrary matrix. So for M not equal to MD, M dagger, it turns out that one can always define a pair of matrices, of unitary matrices, I will call AL, just for a similarity, let me say U dagger, U here. It'll just make it look a little more similar to what I'm going to write now. It turns out that for an arbitrary matrix, you can still make a diagonalization, but you need to introduce a pair of unitary matrices, AL and AR. And the L means it's on the left side and the R on the right side. And these are both unitary. And that in the special case of Hermitian, then these become the same, but in general, they're different. And to the extent that the magnitudes of the eigenvalues are non-degenerate, then these are basically unique up to phases. If there are degeneracies, then it's the same as in the Hermitian case. There's some issue about linear combinations in the degenerate subspace. Now, I'm not going to pursue the mathematics of this. It's relatively straightforward to construct these matrices, et cetera, by noting that an arbitrary square matrix is still such that M dagger M is Hermitian. as is M dagger M. By using the fact that these are Hermitian matrices, basically the point is that A left is the matrix that diagonalizes this Hermitian matrix, and A right is the one that diagonalizes this Hermitian matrix. And starting with that trick, you can figure out how to construct them, et cetera. The main point we're concerned with is there is some such matrix, or such a pair of matrices. So therefore, let me introduce the matrices. I'm going to and specialize to this case. Basically, this quantity the D here means it's the down quark sector can always be rewritten as minus D bar left 0 A left. I'm going to put a D superscript on these unitary matrices as well, just to indicate that they're the ones that diagonalize this. So I'm just going to specialize that relation to ALD dagger MD ARD is equal to M1, M2, M3, which I will identify as the down strange and B quark masses. Incidentally, when you go through this construction, you will generally find that these do not have to be real, since it wasn't a Hermitian matrix to begin with. But you can always, there's some phase arbitrariness in these matrices, and you can use that so that they do become real and positive. Okay, so let me construct these matrices, and then I can rewrite this. And because this is the identity and this is the identity. And this is just minus D bar left MD diagonal D right, where this is what I mean by MD diagonal. And D left, which is DS or B left, is just A L D dagger, D zero left, and D right, D S B right is A right D dagger D zero right. So it's A right dagger D right is D right, and the adjoint of all this gives you D bar left. Let me also insert my 1 plus H over nu here. So I have simply minus, and there's also always a Hermitian conjugate. So I have sum I equals D, S, and B of MI D bar I left D I right times 1 plus H over nu plus Hermitian conjugate. Now I've written out the diagonal matrix explicitly. And of course, mass terms for fermions are always of the form psi bar left, psi right, plus the Hermitian conjugate is psi bar right, psi left, and that's just psi bar psi. So I have, finally, equals minus some. So the Yukawa, L Yukawa, becomes minus the sum over I equals D, S, and B of M, I, D bar, D times 1 plus H over U. So this is a mass term for the, and there's an I here. So these are just the mass terms for the downstrain and bottom quarks. And we've chosen any necessary phases in these A's so that they are real and positive. And so we generate masses for the down quarks and similarly for the up quarks and the electrons and the neutrinos, if at least one way of generating masses for the neutrinos. So not only that, we have also generated Yukawa couplings. Not only have we generated mass terms, but we've generated Yukawa couplings, which are so here's the ith quark, ith down quark, and here's the Higgs. And the coupling, it's like I times the Lagrangian, so the coupling is simply minus I times the mass divided by the weak scale, 246 GeV, and that's it. So the Higgs couples to the fermion. It's a scalar, there's no gamma 5, and it's proportional to the mass of the quark divided by nu. And nu, if I didn't write it, yeah, I wrote it up there. So if the quark is very light, or like the down quark, then, or the electron or whatever, then this is very tiny. But if one's talking about the top quark, which is very heavy, then it's a big coupling. And we saw something similar for the couplings to the W and Z, which were also proportional to the mass squared, in that case, of the gauge boson. So the Higgs actually couples proportional to mass. Any questions so far? So couples proportional to mass. And that's not surprising. The Higgs mechanism generates the mass. And it's flavor diagonal. That's a function of the fact I had only one Higgs doublet, one gamma D, and whatever diagonalized the gamma D for the masses simultaneously diagonalizes for the Higgs coupling. And that's very important. There are no transitions such as you might have had S goes to D, for example. That would be a flavor non-diagonal. And if there were such a thing, then you could have on the other side, you could have, for example, D bar, S bar. So this would be an S to D bar and a D to S bar. So this would take S D bar goes to D S bar. And we will see later that this is disastrous. Such processes are observed in nature, but they go as second order weak. And if they had gone by this, they would have been far too large. Yes?
So why do we choose in QCD to use the basis like for our big Hilbert space of flavors as opposed to like the weak basis? Or I guess we use the mass basis as opposed to the weak basis.
In QCD, well, Let me first make one other comment. I said couples to mass. If you had a non-chiral fermion, then it could have an elementary mass, and that wouldn't be a problem. Okay, now, in QCD, I'll give you two answers. One is that if you're just talking about QCD all by itself, then you could have had, and pretending that was the theory of the world, then in the down quark sector, you could have just as well had something that was sum I equals 1 to 3 d bar I 0 d u slash di. This is now the QCD covariant derivative, minus sum from ij equals 1 to 3 of d bar I 0 m ij d j 0. I could have written that perfectly consistent with QCD. In that case, the very first thing I would have done on line one was to diagonalize this matrix using the same separate left and right. So that, and then those matrices wouldn't have entered anywhere else if I were just talking about QCD, and I would just work in that basis. So really, it didn't have to be diagonal, but you diagonalize to begin with. The second answer is that if you're considering a real world, then you're really considering SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 simultaneously, and the QCD masses are really these guys generated in the by L. Yukawa in what I've been calling the weak sector, but it's all one theory. So the first stage is you generate the masses this way, diagonalize, and then you're there. Okay. I just wanted to say that I will come back to these transitions later, briefly at least, and this goes under the name K0, K0 bar mixing, because this is actually the K0 bar state with strangeness minus 1, and this is the K0 state with strangeness plus 1. And there are transitions between it observed in nature, but they're very tiny. And this one, if it had been present with any appreciable strength here, would have been disastrously large. Similar stories apply in the gauge sector if you didn't have a charm quark. But fortunately, with a single Higgs doublet, there's no Faber off diagonal pieces. If in the MSSM, there are two Higgs doublets, but one doublet couples to the down quarks and the other only to the up quarks. And so in each sector, there's only one, and the same thing happens. But in generalizations, this is the standard model. With extra Higgs doublets, this is a real constraint, a real problem, avoiding the Faber-changing vertices. Okay, now, let me say a word about the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. The eigenvalues in the that we observe, this is from experiment now, are, and I'm going to write them for all sectors, okay, so this is actually about 2 MeV, and this is about 5 MeV. It's not 300 MeV, which you would have guessed. It's just a very tiny amount. The down quark's a little bit heavier than the up. That's why the neutron's heavier than the proton. Most of the mass of the proton is from dynamical QCD effects, not from these masses. And these are so tiny, and that's why we say there's an almost chiral SU2 isospin of the strong interactions. The isospin symmetry is not so much because these are nearly degenerate. They're not. It's just they're both so close to zero that they don't much matter. The electron is about half an MeV. The charm quark is about 1.3 GeV. 1.3, so this is almost 1,000 times heavier. And the strange quark is about 105 MeV. And the muon the strange quark is about 100, let's say 100. And this is about 105 MeV. And this is about 174 GeV. So it's much, much heavier than, it's even heavier than the W and Z, twice as heavy, and almost at the electroweak scale. This is about 5. And this is about 1.8. So nobody understands this pattern. This is very light. This is intermediate. This is much heavier. For all the quarks have a mass of about 300 MeV just from the QCD stuff that has nothing to do with this. And most of the proton mass comes from that. This mass difference breaks isospin. The fact that MS is 100 MeV indicates the SU3. The global SU3 is broken, right, because of that. And that's sort of typical of mass splittings. These small numbers come from the pion mass, which, remember, was an almost Goldstone boson of the chiral symmetry there. So anyway, that's what we observe in the whole pattern, why this is so much heavier, and then the splittings within, like they're even within this family, there's a factor of 10 here between this and these. And there's a big difference within this, between these. And nobody understands this pattern. So that this is the flavor, or half of what's called the flavor problem. There's nothing inconsistent about it. It's just we don't understand it. It's not like the gauge sector where things are constrained, and because all these matrices were arbitrary. Yes?
Is there an anthropic argument for these masses?
There are anthropic arguments, especially here and here. If you want to have a complicated chemistry, you need a complicated spectra of nuclei, some of which are stable and others are unstable. And if you fiddled with these masses very much, you wouldn't, like, for example, if the up quark were heavier than the down quark, then let me put it a different way. If the down quark were much heavier than the up quark, then you wouldn't have light nuclei. Everything would just turn into neutrons. How compelling those arguments are, I don't know. And nobody's given, I mean, these heavier families don't seem to play much role in ordinary nature. About the only quasi-anthropic argument anyone's given for these is that you need these to have CP violation, and you need CP violation to have more matter than antimatter. Anything else? Okay, let me now do the other half of the problem, though, because I'm not, I want to rewrite my weak interactions in terms of these guys. So I think I'll. So we saw yesterday that the weak charge currents, well, it was L equals minus G over 2 root 2 J mu w mu minus plus j mu dagger w mu plus. And the charge raising current was the sum m equals 1 to 3 of nu bar m 0 gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 e m 0 plus u bar m 0 gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 d m 0. This was the weak interaction basis. It's by definition diagonal because you've got three quark SU2, you know, doublets, and we just label the three doublets as 1, 2, and 3, and by definition, the transitions are just don't mix the weak states. However, we've seen that the DL0 is ALD times the mass eigenstates. And similarly, the UL0 is related to some mass eigenstates by a different unitary transformation, AU. And similarly, even for the others. I'm sort of pretending now that the neutrinos are just like everything else. On Thursday, I will talk about other possibilities, but I'm not focusing on neutrinos at this point. So I have to rewrite this in terms of the mass eigenstates, and it becomes where V sub H, which H means hadron here, it's usually called the CKM matrix for Kabibo, Kobayashi, Moskawa, is just given by A L U dagger A L D, and V sub L for lepton, which is called the PMNS matrix, Pontecorvo, Maki, Nakagawa, and Sakai. Actually, for some weird convention, there's a dagger here. That's equal to AL nu dagger ALE. In other words, let's just focus on this one. These states are different from these. They're two different states, merely connected by the weak interactions. And when I diagonalize, I have to diagonalize both sectors. And the thing that comes in is this matrix, which need not be the identity. If ALU and ALD were the same, that would be the identity. There'd be no problem. So, but you can have a mismatch between SU2 cross U1, that is the fermion part of it, and L Yukawa. This one wanted to pick out the mass eigenstates. This one wanted to pick out the weak eigenstates. Or if you prefer, it's a mismatch between these and the QCD eigenstates, since we, as we already said, that's already diagonalized. So you can have transitions, such as down into up by the 1-1 element, or strange into up by the 1-2 element, or bottom into up by the 1-3 element, etc. The CKM matrix is unitary because the adjoint of this times its adjoint will give you, the adjoint is ALD dagger ALU, so it's clearly unitary. And this is what we observed in the weak interactions. Now, I want to discuss this a little bit more. For the moment, let us ignore the third family. In that case, if it just didn't exist, I would have, instead of a 3x3 unitary matrix, I would have a 2x2 unitary matrix. So in that case, V would be of the form, well, let's ask, how many parameters are there in a 2x2 unitary matrix? Does anybody know? How many? There are actually 4 parameters in a 2x2 unitary matrix. You start out with 4 complex numbers, so that's 8 parameters, but the unitarity condition gives you 4 constraints, so there are 4 parameters. And it turns out it's 1 angle and 3 phases. And one can actually write the most general 2x2 unitary matrix can be written as e to the minus I alpha u, e to the minus I alpha c. This is going to be a somewhat suggestive notation, cos theta c minus sine theta c minus sine theta c cos theta c times e to the plus I alpha d e to the plus I alpha s. This is a matrix involving 1 angle, which will be, of course, the Kabibel angle. It's a rotation. But on either side, there are diagonal matrices of phases. And there seem to be 4 phases here, contrary to the 3 that I stated. The reason is that if you multiply these out, you'll find that the entries in the end only depend on differences between pairs of phases. And there's, with 4 phases, there's only 3 differences. So one of the 4 is redundant. So that's, so in general, if one had 2 families, then you would have a weak interaction of the form u bar times, let me call it u bar prime left, c bar prime left, well, I'll just write 1 minus gamma 5, and then b prime and s prime. This would be the most general possibility. However, notice I put in primes here, and that's because the overall phase of a state in quantum mechanics is not observable. So I can simply define d to be e to the I alpha d times d prime, and similarly for the others. And so what I'm saying is that the 3 phases are unobservable. And therefore, you may as well just forget about these and say that it is the u bar, c bar, et cetera. I'll call this V Habibal, just a rotation part, ES. So this was what was known before the discovery of the third family. There was no room for CP violation. There were phases, but they're not observable phases, so it's not real CP violation. And this could account for the whole structured weak interactions, charge current weak interactions. It required the charm quark. If you didn't have the charm quark, then there'd be one state here and two here. It wouldn't be a unitary matrix. It would mess up everything. And in that case, there would have been, it turns out, there would have been Z-mediated K bar K transitions, and there would have also been huge second order effects that would be very much larger. With the charm quark, it turns out that these Z vertices become diagonal, just like the Higgs ones, and it turns out that without the charm quark, you would have only had the up quark here, and it would have been about five orders of magnitude too large. But with the charm quark, there are cancellations. It could be either the up or the charm, and it coincides with what's observed. And the charm quark mass was actually predicted this way prior to its discovery. OK, so what we have here, we have one angle plus three phases minus three quark phases. Remember, one of the four quark phases is redundant. You could just as well pick one of them to be just a one here. So you're left with one angle. However, by the time the standard model was written, it was well known that there was CP violation in nature. And there had to be some place where there were observable phases. And this was quite a mystery. And Kobayashi and Maskawa's contribution was to realize that if you go to three families, then the Habibal Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix turns out to have three angles plus six phases minus five phases. You can now, the most general unitary 3x3 has nine parameters. It's nine elements, nine complex numbers, 18 parameters, nine unitarity constraints, nine parameters. Three of them are rotation angles and six are phases. And you can remove five quark phases. And so you get three plus one. There's one observable phase. And so this was how CP violation could be incorporated into the standard model. Are there any questions?
Could you just go over the counting angle?
I'll just say it quickly, but that's the sort of thing it's better to sit down and do it quietly. But you have 2 times 9. There's 9 complex numbers in a 3x3 matrix. They're complex. And then there are 9 unitarity constraints. So there are 9 parameters, of which it turns out that you can easily show that the SO3 is a subgroup. And so there are 3 angles and 6 phases. You can redefine the six quark phases, but only one of them is redundant. It's only the differences that come in here. So there's really only five that you can eliminate. So you're left with one. Yes?
Can you give an example of a process that's CP violating?
Yeah. Okay, I wanted to discuss a little about the unitarity, et cetera, and then just a little bit about the CP, and I don't think I'll have time today for both, so let me, in view of your question, let me jump ahead to that aspect, and then I'll come back to the unitarity test. I will say at this point, one of the big I have been presenting the standard model, but of course, there's all kinds of possible extensions of the standard model. So one of the tests that one can do is to test whether this matrix is really unitary. It has to be unitary within the standard model with, you know, consistent with all basic axioms such as conservation of probability. But it, if there were physics beyond the standard model, such as new gauge interactions or new fermions or something, and you had not taken into that into account, that might show up as an apparent non-unitarity of the CKM matrix. So it's very important to test that. But let me sort of jump ahead to a little about CP. The K0 state is DS bar, and the K0 bar state is S bar D. And these are CP conjugates of each other. Because basically, charge conjugation turns a this into a D bar S, and well, that's the essential element of it. These are eigenstates of P, with so that, but that's not the relevant point. The point is that they are CP conjugates of each other, and we know that P is violated strongly, so it's CP that we're focusing on. And this one has strangeness 1, and this is strangeness minus 1. And of course, the strong interactions conserve strangeness, so you can have pi minus P can go to K0 lambda, but pi minus P does not go to K0 bar lambda. Lambda has strangeness minus 1, so this would conserve strangeness. This doesn't. Okay, now, however, when you turn on the weak interaction, and you expect if you only had strong interactions in nature and CP, if strangeness is conserved, these should be the mass eigenstates. So these are the mass eigenstates for strong interactions. However, the weak interactions do not conserve strangeness, and there are second-order processes such as the ones that I drew earlier. This means that there's really six diagrams here for each of these can be up, charm, or top. And this would be a W minus going across, and this would be a W plus going across. This is a second order weak interaction diagram. It's very tiny, but it does cause a mixing. So K0, which is here, K0 bar, which is here, H weak, you know, second order, does not equal zero. It's incredibly tiny, but it's not equal to zero. And there are other diagrams in which the quarks go this way and the W's go this way. You have to take everything into account. So that means you really have, for the kaons, a 2x2 matrix, which is the mass of the K0, mass K0 bar, and then the I'll call it M12, which is proportional to this. CPT symmetry, which we, as far as we know, is a good symmetry, says that the diagonal elements have to be equal. So I'm just going to assume that by erasure here. M12 is second order in weak interactions. Weak interactions are incredibly weak, so this is very tiny. But even a tiny mixing is important if the diagonal elements are the same. In fact, no matter how tiny this is, the mass eigenstates will be 45 degree admixtures. So the mass eigenstates under the weak interactions are K1, which is K0 minus K0 bar over root 2, also called the K short, and the K2, which is K0 plus K0 bar over root 2, also called the K long. One can, by indirect effects that are analogous almost to an interferometer, one can actually measure the difference in masses between these. And basically, it turns out to be about 4 times 10 to the minus 6 electron volts. It's very, very tiny. I don't have time to go into how this is done. It's very similar to the neutrino oscillations that I'll talk about on Thursday. One can theoretically calculate this from the Feynman diagrams. I'm not going to go through the calculation, but that's the, it depends on the charm quark mass, and that was how it was predicted. You could do it, the top quark's not very important here for just the mass difference. But this also, if you didn't have charm or top, would be a disaster, and there'd also be those tree level things from the Z or Higgs if they had Faber changing vertices. But in the standard model, it agrees with this, for the observed charm mass. Okay. Now, just to finish this up and answer the question. We have seen that the weak interactions violate, the charge current weak interactions violate P maximally and violate C maximally, but they seem to be invariant under CP unless there are some complex phases floating around in the coefficients that are observable. Now, the CP, the K0 gives you K0 bar. That means it's actually, I didn't write it before. Because of the P, there's actually a minus sign here. I should have written the minus sign up there. I'm not going to change it now. But these are mass eigenstates, or are CP eigenstates. And basically, the minus one is because they're pseudoscalar, and you've got the P as well. Okay, that means that the CP of the so-called of K0 minus plus I K0 bar over root 2 is equal to plus or minus the thing you started out with. And there's not an I. I don't know why I wrote that. Did I write the I up there? No. Good. So these states that I called K short and K long are eigenstates of CP. Now, a dominant decay mode for these states is into pi plus, pi minus, or pi zero, pi zero. And in fact, it's easy to show that the CP of a pi plus, pi minus state is always even. And I'll leave that as an exercise for you. And similarly, CP of pi zero is even. And this is for actually j equals zero. If they're in an orbital, if they're in a total spin zero state. You can also show that the CP of a pi plus, pi minus, pi zero state is odd. Or at least the main component of it. You can get a little CP even if you have orbital submomenta, but it's mainly odd. Okay. So what that means that what you expect is that one of the eigenstates, the K short, that means the K short should decay into, can decay into 2 pi, and the K long would be expected to decay into 3 pi. These are angular momentum zero. I'll be done in a second. And the and this should be very fast, and this should be very slow. S means short-lived, L means long-lived, because there's much less phase space here. And in fact, the lifetime here is about 9 times 10 to the minus 11 seconds experimentally. And here it's about 5 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. So that's what you expect if CP is conserved. However, in 1964, the famous Fitch-Conan experiment at Brookhaven Lab in Long Island, New York, observed K long goes to 2 pi with a branching ratio of about 3 parts in 1,000. Implying CP must be violated. And it could either be violated because the mass matrix we wrote wasn't correct, and that there, or basically I implicitly assumed that the M12 was real there, which it would be if you didn't have any phases in your weak interactions, if CP were conserved. Either there are phases, and these are not exactly the right eigenstates, or there's some CP violation in the decay amplitude. And in fact, the answer is that those diagrams on top, if you only have up and charm, have to be real These have to be the right eigenstates, and there's also no way diagram you can draw for CP violation in the decay amplitude. But with the top quark, the 3x3 matrix, you have interference of all the diagrams, and that extra phase in the matrix, and I'll parameterize it tomorrow, can lead to a complex M12, and it can lead to a mixing so that these are not quite the mass eigenstates, and they each have a little bit of admixture of the other CP. And there's also some, even most of the effect is there in the mixing. There's even a tinier effect in the decay amplitude. So that's the example. And this has now been studied in great detail here, and it's also been studied in even more detail in the heavy bottom quark sector, where there's a very similar phenomenon of mixing of the BD bar and B bar D states. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, I'll finish up this this discussion tomorrow, and then I want to talk in some more detail about the Higgs boson and its couplings and some theoretical aspects, constraints on it, and then the actual discovery a year and a half ago. So that continues tomorrow.